Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. We'll spend the first part of this hour talking with Mary Ann Hackett, president of Illinois Right to Life, about yesterday's announcement by Illinois Senator Peter Fitzgerald that he will not be seeking a second term in the U.S. Senate. This might come as a blow to the pro-life community in Illinois. We'll find out what Mary Ann has to say in the course of the first part of this hour of Issues Etc. And we'll get an update on the Access to Clinics bill that's working its way through Illinois and see exactly what Mary Ann would like us to know about that. In the second part of this program, we'll be joined by Dr. Ergun Kaner. He is professor of theology and church history at Criswell College in Dallas, Texas, and author of the book Unveiling Islam and a forthcoming book called More Than a Prophet. We'll be talking about the different types of Muslims, Sunni, Shiite, and I'm sure that there's some others which are not as prominently featured in the news today, and get a little primer in the sects of Islam. Our phone numbers for this final hour, 505-750-1800-730-2727. Perhaps you saw the story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Fitzgerald won't seek second term in the Senate. Republicans scramble, Democrats celebrate. Or, if you're like me, I was up very early this morning driving north, listening to the radio, and it was one of the biggest news items being broadcast this morning. What does it mean? We'll find out right now. Mary Ann Hackett, president of Illinois Right to Life, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be back.
Your general reaction to Senator Fitzgerald's announcement yesterday?
Well, we were just very disappointed with it. He's been a 100% pro-life vote that we could depend on, and I think he's done a good job as senator. I think he's probably has an accurate appraisal of the state being very Democrat, and it was cost him considerable money of his own to run again. And also, I think he's alienated some of the, quote, moderate Republicans, and probably they would be resistant to giving Republican money to his run again. To tell you the truth, Pastor, I think the moderate and left-leaning Republicans were appalled when such a conservative as Peter Fitzgerald won in the first place. And I think they would... there were already people lining up to run against him in the primary, and I think they wouldn't be of much help to him, and I think he's perceived that clearly, but it's a great loss to us.
All right. You said he had a 100% pro-life vote.
Yes, he was a dependable pro-life voter.
And but apart from his voting record, how did he function as a leader of the pro-life movement in Illinois?
Well, he wasn't active in the pro-life movement at all, I don't think. But, it's very hard for us to find legislators who we can depend on to defend life. And even though a lot of the legislators, senators, representatives, are not what you'd call active in the pro-life movement, their heart is in the right place, and they are consistent in their vote. And, you know, much of our damage is done through the legislatures, and if we have someone that we can always depend on to vote in defense of life, that's a big thing.
What is the general atmosphere in the state of Illinois? And then, of course, as we broaden that out, of course, to its representation in the Senate and the House, what's the general atmosphere regarding the pro-life movement?
The pro-life movement is in bad trouble since the election. The Democrats swept Illinois. Oddly enough, the pro-life cause won very well across the country, but in Illinois it didn't. And so we find it's going to be very difficult to get any of our bills through. There's a hostility. Most people have to pass the litmus test of being pro-abortion before they can even run for office on the Democratic ticket. So we're going to have a very difficult four years, and we have to get our forces together and determine what battles we must fight and what are important.
What about the other Illinois Senator, Dick Durbin? Where does he stand on the life
He's
issue?
He's totally pro-abortion. In fact, he even refuses to vote against the partial birth abortion. He opposed the ban that would stop partial birth abortion. He's really an anti-life person all around. And the interesting thing is he was one of the sponsors of a puppy protection bill.
What is that?
A puppy protection bill. He sponsored a bill and promoted a bill that would protect puppies from owners who abuse them. But he will not protect the unborn baby in the womb.
Who are some of the Republican nominees who are being talked about to replace Fitzgerald, and where do they stand individually on the life issue?
Well, Jim Edgar has been, that name has been floated. He's pro-abortion. I think we don't need a rerun of his term. I don't think he certainly wouldn't get any support from the pro-life conservative community. We know how he is in office. We had him for two terms in office, I believe it was two terms. Tom McCracken is one of the names suggested. He's the president of the RTA board, or chairman of the RTA board. He is pro-life. Patrick O'Malley is pro-life, is another name that's been floated. Jim Ryan is another pro-lifer. Robert Shillerstrom is another pro-lifer. Judy Bart Trepinka is not, although she's considered now a leader in the Republican Party in Illinois. She isn't pro-life, but she is a team player, and I think if she were elected, it's possible that she would vote with the president and with the Republican Party on issues of life, but that's not a dependable person to send to office. Some of the others that have been mentioned, John Ryan, who is an investment banker, or John Cox, who is an attorney and was a candidate last time, Jim Oberweis. Jim Oberweis's record is sketchy. He sometimes is pro-life and sometimes he isn't. He's not a dependable person to send. My fear is that a lot of conservative pro-lifers will decide they'd like to run, and the primary will be a battle, and will lose the election.
Who would you favor on the Republican side to take Fitzgerald's place? In other words, you've talked about some of these not being reliable pro-life voters.
Right.
Which one on the balance would be the most reliable pro-life voter if elected?
I personally think that Patrick O'Malley would be, but I think he took a very difficult position in the last election by refusing to endorse Jim Ryan after O'Malley had lost in the primary. So that's exactly the type of division I'm speaking about that will lose it for us.
What did O'Malley run for in the last election?
He ran for governor, and Jim Ryan ran for governor, and lost to Blagojevich. There were deep contentions between them, and when Ryan was selected as the candidate, the Republican candidate, O'Malley refused to endorse him. And you know, they're both pro-lifers, and I think that's a bad mistake, and I think it hurt O'Malley for the future.
What about the Democrat side? Who are the nominees, and where do they stand on this life issue?
Well, the nominees are all, as far as I know, pro-abortion. Gary Chico, who was the head of the president of the Chicago School Board. Dan Hines, whose father has been in politics, and he's an Illinois state controller. Barack Obama, he's a Chicago law professor. Maria Pappas might be a better one. Although I don't know of her pro-life record, I think she might lean in that direction. They don't have any good ones either. I have heard that Glenn Plachard's name has surfaced. He would be a good candidate for the pro-life cause if a Democrat were to win. He's a consistent and a reliable pro-lifer, and he's a man of integrity.
Mary Ann, is this a sad day for the pro-life movement in the state of Illinois and for the pro-life cause in the National Senate?
Well, it's a difficult loss, I think, for us, because the chances of getting another pro-lifer in will be difficult because the state is so Democratic. Yes, I think it is a sad day, and I think we're faced with that type of thing. We can't lose hope. We can't stop fighting. We have to do what the Lord bids us to do in this, and that is to defend the unborn. And we're going to have difficult times, but the victory is the Lord's, and it will be in His time. But that doesn't mean we can rest on our laurels.
You wanted to bring us up to date on the Freedom of Access to Clinic bill.
Yeah, so I was notified today that the FACE bill, which is the Freedom of Access to Clinic entrances, has been assigned to the Health Committee, which is the worst committee that it could be in, and the predicament we're in is that it will undoubtedly be approved and sent out to the Senate floor from this committee, because they're opposed to the life position. They're anti-life. But what we're hoping to do is prevail upon the senators not to vote for this bill, whether they vote simply present or they don't show up or they vote against it. This bill is going to be a disaster for Illinois. There are going to be lawsuits over it. It'll be taken to the Supreme Court, probably. It will deny people's free speech rights, which of course was just the decision that the Supreme Court ruled on the Shidler case, that people have the free speech rights to do to protest in this respect.
Now, what in particular does the FACE bill, the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances bill, what would it do?
Well, it means it can't interfere with anyone trying to have an abortion. That is, the sidewalk counselors who want to give the woman information and offer help will be not permitted to do that. It's the next round, if I may say so, against the free speech of pro-lifers. It's odd, but everybody, the animal rights people, the labor people, the feminists, everybody has rights but pro-lifers now.
What can our listeners do about this FACE bill?
Well, they can contact their senators and ask them not to vote for this bill because it's not a bill that will promote freedom of speech or freedom of life in Illinois or defense of life. It's a very bad bill. It's a very bad bill even if you happen to consider yourself to be pro-choice, to deny the free speech rights of a whole group of people because they don't agree with you. It's a bad bill for everybody.
Marianne Hackett, thank you for being our guest again on Issues Etc. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
Marianne Hackett is president of Illinois Right to Life. You can visit them on the web, Illinois Right to Life, all one word, IllinoisRightToLife.org, or you can call them at area code 312-422-9300. That's area code 312-422-9300. For the remainder of this hour, we'll be speaking with Dr. Ergun Kaner. Have you been confused lately, perhaps for the last several years, as Islam has been in the news more and more, with the various kinds of Muslims? That it, not by nationality, but what's a Shiite? What is a Sunni? What's the difference between the two? How do these differences play into international politics and, in particular, the conflict in Iraq? What does all of it mean? We're going to talk with Dr. Ergun Kaner, professor of theology and church history at Criswell College in Dallas, and co-author of the book Unveiling Islam and a forthcoming book called More Than a Prophet, during the remainder of this hour. If you'd like to join us, our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Kaner, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Kaner, first of all, give us a list of the various types or sects within Islam.
Oh, good gracious. If you were going to try to list them, there are, according to Islamic sources, close to 50. Now, of the major types, they all fit, sort of like Christianity fits into Protestant, Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox. Within Islam, there is the major three, and that is Sunni, Shiite, and Sufi. But then you have many, many subsets, such as Alawite, Wahhabi, Druze, and others.
Okay, let's deal with the major three, if we could, and maybe if we have time, we might be able to spend some time in the larger of the lesser sects of Islam. Before we get into those three, what accounts for the divisions in Islam? Is there a point in history where we can...
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. As you know, when Muhammad died in 632 A.D., when Muhammad died, he did not leave marching orders. His death caught him and his followers by surprise, and you had a power struggle, for lack of a better term, a power struggle over who would be the leader. It came down to one major question. If the leader of Islam, nobody else is called a prophet, as you know, everyone is called a caliph, but if the caliph is going to be a genetic, you know, blood relative, so to speak, of Muhammad, that's the answer. The Shiites believed he must be must be by heritage from the house of Muhammad. And they were followers of one who was called Ali. And they said it has to be someone. Ali married Muhammad's daughter, and so, it must be this. But Muhammad's best friend and the first convert to Islam was named Abu Bakr. And Abu Bakr was the by proxy leader of Islam. The rest of the Muslims decided to follow Abu Bakr, and they became Sunni. About 90%, 10% split. To this day, it still holds about 85%, 10%, and then 5% for the other groups. So 85% of the world Muslims fall into the category of known as the Sunni, and they trace their heritage to Abu Bakr, who they believe was the first caliph. Because the 10% of the Muslims were, did not get their way, they split. They split completely off, and they became followers of the Way, or Shia, and thus we have the term Shiites. They did not; they don't recognize any caliph until Ali, who was actually the fourth caliph according to the Sunni.
Now, between the Sunnis and the Shiites, are these the only major differences between these two sects?
Oh, no. And that's a very prescient question. I rarely get asked that. That's good to be asked. There are many differences between them. The third major group are the Sufi. And for lack of a better term, the Sufi fall into the category of perhaps the charismatics of the Muslim world, the mystics of the Muslim world. When someone asks me, do you believe that Islam is a peaceful religion, I will say there are sects that are peaceful. And the Sufi, S-U-F-I, the Sufi have built their entire Islamic system on peace. They deny any kind of jihad. They deny any kind of outward acts of warfare, with some exceptions, with some small exceptions. And so the Sufi, you know, have built their belief system on an activity of peace. The Shiites and the Sufi and the Sunni, they differ on their interpretations of the six ways, the five pillars, and the use of the hadith, H-A-D-I-T-H. This is huge. The hadith is the great unknown in American Islam. As far as our American culture is concerned, we don't really know much about. We know the Quran, but we don't know the hadith. The hadith were the sayings of Muhammad. And the sayings of Muhammad collected by al-Bukhari and al-Muslim and a couple of others, these collections become the constitution for any Islamic state. And so when the Shiites say they are much more adherent to Islam, what they are meaning is they adhere to a stricter form of the hadith.
Is this, we hear sometimes, and the term is not thrown around so much as it was about 20 years ago, Islamic fundamentalists or fundamentalism. What is generally being signaled by that particular Western characterization?
Yeah, that is Western characterization. There's no such thing. When someone says, oh, he's an Islamic extremist, this is sort of what we hear now in our American culture. We say, well, those who follow jihad, they are extremists. Only in America would this ever be said. Myself, I am Turkish, 20 generations back Muslim. You know, I'm the first Christian. I converted to Jesus Christ as Lord, Savior, and God, you know, when I was a senior in high school. We never hear this term extremist. They believe they are strict purists. They adhere to the Quran. As a matter of fact, when Bin Laden comes on television, you know, or has a recording released, the first group to which he speaks are not the infidels, not the akafir, but he speaks to the other Muslims and he says, you have been obliged, you have been fard-ain, is the Arabic term, you have been fard-ain, you have been obliged to holy war, what is holding you back?
Now, do the Shiites consider the Sunnis to be heretical, or, and vice versa?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. There is a gulat, the term gulat means cult. They consistently declare each other cults for a number of reasons. For instance, as it applies to our present conflict, in Iraq, we are having discussions even yesterday over who will run the country. And we saw just a few days ago a Shiite imam hacked to death. Actually, he was an ulema, a scholar, hacked to death because he was seen to be complicitous with Saddam Hussein. Why would that be of any importance? Well, the thing to remember about Iraq is this. It has been minority run. It has been like South Africa. 20% of the Muslims in Iraq, only 20%, are Sunni. 60, and I would argue that perhaps closer to 70% of the Muslims in Iraq are Shiite. And so Hussein has constantly had a war against the Shiites. As a matter of fact, after the last Gulf War, he bombed one of the Shiite holy sites, which was the place of death for Muhammad's grandson, Hussein. And because there was such an outcry against Hussein for doing so, Saddam Hussein for doing so, he had to help rebuild those sites.
Now, you mentioned the conflict in Iraq. Of what, at least ostensibly, of what sect is or was Saddam Hussein a member?
Yeah, and I think you said it very clearly when you say ostensibly. Ostensibly, he was a Sunni. And now, even Osama bin Mohammed bin Laden, the leader in the Taliban, he believed that Hussein was a bad Muslim. He dressed in secular garb. He only wore the gefya when he needed to. And so he was seen as a bad Muslim. What is interesting is that bin Laden is a Wahhabi. And the Wahhabi are a subset of the Sunni. They are a subset. And so because of this, they had more in common than, say, bin Laden and the old Ayatollah Khomeini. They would not have anything in common because that's Sunni versus Shiite. These are two subsets of Sunni, bin Laden and Hussein. And this is why when somebody says, oh, there was no connection, oh, my goodness. Anyone who understands Islam knows there's an incredible connection between the two, and anyone who has followed history knows that there was an incredible connection between the two. That is the reason why they called for a fatwa after the bombing started, that bin Laden called his followers to join with Saddam Hussein. They are joined together as two denominations within the same movement.
One more question on Saddam Hussein. How would it be perceived by any Muslim, regardless of their sect in Islam, for essentially a secular leader such as Saddam Hussein to portray himself in the art of propaganda as a great teacher of Islam, and to use Islam and its teachings toward his own secular and geopolitical purposes?
Well, some would say that the movement now of what they would call, again, Islamicists or extreme Islam are using it for geopolitical aims. I always make the point that, and we just came back from Washington, D.C., where I dealt with this, this is not geopolitical. The last words that Hussein said on that videotape before, you know, after the bombing that began that Wednesday some month ago, he said, long live Iraq, long live the Iraqi people, and long live jihad, holy war. This is not, for them, a battle against America, the great geopolitical superpower, the only surviving superpower. This is against America, the perceived Christian nation. And this is their crusade. That's why it's declared a jihad.
Some have speculated that that America, in positioning itself, and we've only got a minute here before we go to break, America positioning itself in this war with Iraq, will unite Muslims, regardless of their various denominations, against America. Is that a fair characterization?
No. I think it will unite some Muslims. But it will not, nothing will unite Sunni and Shiite and Sufi in any common cause. They will always have a fundamental distrust, dislike, distaste for one another.
When we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Ergun Kaner. He's professor of theology and church history at Criswell College in Dallas, Texas. He's co-author of the book Unveiling Islam and a forthcoming book, More Than a Prophet. We're talking about the different kinds or the different types of Muslim. If you have a question or a comment on this subject, feel free to use our call-in number, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I think with respect at this point to our present conflict in Iraq and the future, it seems that we would all do well to understand the theological and cultural differences within Islam. We might understand a little bit better. We might actually be able to understand some things that seem broadly misunderstood. I've got a question for Dr. Kaner when we come back, and that has to do with whether or not the Bush administration and the American people in general would do well to understand these differences better and how things might change if they did. We'll be right back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What did Jesus say and do on the night he was arrested? In our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, the very first Easter, Dr. Paul Meyer retells for your family and your children the story of Jesus' betrayal, arrest, crucifixion, and resurrection. You can order the very first Easter online. Go to our website at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book. Issuesetc.org. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, be sure to ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, the very first Easter. The cost is $12.99, 1-800-325-3040. Call weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040.
By death came man. Now who said that?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the powerful book, Genesis and the Decay of the Nations.
Ken, you've often said that the Bible teaches that it was man's sin that brought death, but Charles Darwin said something quite different, right?
Well, in Darwin's scheme of things, he saw war, famine, and death as being good because they generated the higher animals and finally man himself. You see, right at the end of Darwin's book, The Origin of the Species, he said, quote, "Thus from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of higher animals, directly follows," end of quote. In other words, what Darwin said was this: by death came man. Things that we should see as terrible and ugly, such as war, famine, and death, Darwin actually considered good because they're a part of the process of evolution. You know, this belief is in sharp contrast to what the Word of God says. We're told in Corinthians that by man came death, exactly the opposite of what Darwin taught. This is a very important point. So many Christians think they can add evolution to the Bible, but it's impossible. You see, sin led to death.
That key biblical teaching that sin leads to death is covered in much more detail in Ken's booklet, Why Is There Death and Suffering? To get your free copy, go to our popular and attractive website, AnswersRadio.com. Next time you're surfing the internet, go to AnswersRadio.com.
:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis. Occasional showers overnight. Low of about 51 for tomorrow. Mostly cloudy with a continued chance for rain. High near 72 right now. Overcast and 70 in St. Louis. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Westbound 40 is heavy and slow west of Kings Highway to Hanley. Brentwood to McKnight and bumper to bumper from Ballas to Mason. Westbound 70 stop and go from 170 to the Rock Road. Westbound 44 is slow in the right lane at 270. Northbound 270 slows Page to Dorset, then in the right lanes exiting onto westbound 70. Eastbound 40 between Jefferson and the Poplar Street Bridge, there's some heavy traffic there. And northbound 55 between Park Avenue and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane. That's traffic and weather on AM 850 KFUO.
Do you ever have a question or a comment that you would like to share with the staff at AM 850 KFUO? Why not send us an email? It's fast and easy. Our main email address is webmaster@kfuo.org. Or for staff email addresses, go to kfuo.org and click the Contact KFUO button. We enjoy receiving your questions and comments, so feel free to contact us. Our main email address again is webmaster@kfuo.org.
Friday on Issues, Etc. We're going to be talking with Dr. Norman Nagel. This is a rare opportunity to have Dr. Nagel in studio and to walk with him through the seven words of Christ from the cross that are recorded in the four Gospels. We'll be dealing with every one of them and having his unique insights on each. Friday on Issues, Etc. The General Conversation, The Passion of Jesus Christ. Also Friday, a two-hour discussion on the events of Passion Week with Dr. Lane Berglund, author of Reading the Bible with Understanding. Now, if you have a question or a comment on Islam, you can give us a call in the next 25 minutes of the program. We're talking with Dr. Ergun Kaner, author of the book Unveiling Islam. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's go to Kurt, who's calling from his car. Kurt, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Your guest said that the way he was talking was it was well nigh impossible for Shiites and Sunni to make common cause. Well, how in the world did Saddam Hussein get many of his Shiite soldiers, if it's true that 70% of Iraq is Shiite, to fight a very bloody war with Shiite Iran? Did he have to go behind them with a pistol and force them to fight? I don't think that happened.
Actually, it did happen in many cases. This is what we continue to hear about the coercion of the Fedayeen, men being dragged out of their homes and told you have to fight at pistol point. However, on the deeper question, many of the Shiite Muslims who had lived under the Hussein regime had been born and raised in this. You have to understand, it has been Sunni rule in Iraq since 1921. Of course, following World War I, at the time, the Lord of the Admiralty was Winston Churchill. And Churchill turned over the country, the newly formed country of Iraq, to the leadership of the Sunni. And so many of the Muslims have known nothing else in Iraq since then. Now, of course, from what, 21 through almost World War II, you had the British stronghold, and then when the British left, they saw the British as the enemy. So when the British left, even if it's Hussein, and he's a Muslim that we do not like, and of course, their mosques and our mosques are not the same, say the Shiites, he's still one of us. He's still a Muslim, even though he is not our type of Muslim. You can compare this again to perhaps the Peace of Westphalia, the warfare between the Reformation movements, the Lutheran movement and the French-Swiss movement and the German-Swiss movement.
Let's go back to the phones. Matt is calling from Richmond Heights. Matt, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I would like to ask, I heard the other day on the radio that Saddam Hussein was his family anyway, his parents were Christians and their predecessors. I wondered, Dr. Keener, is that true?
I'm sorry, I barely heard what he said.
He said he had heard that Saddam Hussein's parents, at the very least, were Christians. Is this true?
Well, no, I've heard a number of these things, but they are, as far as I know, all just rumor. If it's sustained to me, I would be happy to, or proven to me, I would be happy to speak of it. But there is one who was a leader in Hussein's regime. Tariq Aziz was called a Christian. He is of the type of Christian that is exposed in Iraq in the public square, which is the Coptic movement. Eastern Orthodox, Coptic, derivative, those that at the Council of Nicaea in 325 had been kicked out. But I have wonderful news, of course, for all of us who are believers in Jesus Christ, and that is that there is an underground church supported by Lutherans and Baptists and others. They have existed even without any kind of help, even under great stress of death in many of their cases. There is an underground church in Iraq and an underground movement that will be exposed as we pray that religious liberty be allowed in Iraq. We will find that there is a body of Christ that's existed there and has fervently shared the gospel of Jesus.
Of the two major Muslim groups, the Sunnis and the Shiites, are they both equally anti-Western?
Ah, well, in our book, More Than a Prophet, which comes out next month, a follow-up to Unveiling Islam, we deal with the issue of both of these movements and as far as their determination against America. In both of their belief systems, eschatological, prophetic belief systems, it is based on conquest. Islam will conquer the world. You remember now, 20 years ago, Ayatollah Khomeini said, we will turn America into an Islamic nation. And that is their end and their aim. And in so doing, if American Christianity gets in the way, then that is their goal.
In the Western world, and I guess of greatest interest in America in particular, of the 2 to 7 million Muslims that are recorded here in the United States, how do the numbers break down between Sunni, Shiite, and Sufi?
Yeah, this was difficult for me because, of course, I was not born in this country. I was, my father being a Muazzin, we came to this country as Islamic missionaries, to use an Americanized term. And I began to see the panoply, I began to see the landscape of Islam. I would say a vast majority of Muslims here in America, perhaps 85%, are Sunni. I teach here in Texas. I will be teaching at Liberty University starting this fall. I think you will run into the vast majority of the Muslims you run into are Sunni. The rest of them are divided among Shiite, Sufi on the West Coast, and Nation of Islam, which I never saw Nation of Islam until I came to America.
And on that point, it's mentioned in your book, how would, if we can use the term mainstream Islam, view the Nation of Islam?
Well, we saw them with a bit of a scant view. Like I said, I was never exposed to this. This was an American Muslim movement, and it began as the Five Percenters, of course, a movement to get national recognition of a black country here in America. It was not accepted from 1923, when it began to form, until the 1960s. It was not accepted by mainstream Islam until Malcolm made the pilgrimage. When Malcolm made Hajj, the Sunni subsumed a group of the nation underneath them. There is still a political wing. There's still a political movement called the Nation of Islam, but by and large, they are still seen as an aberration. The other nation was accepted into the Sunni movements And, you know, since then, they have not been known as the nation.
Okay. You are from Turkey, and perhaps you could also clear up a few misconceptions or gaps in the general knowledge of people who've been consuming the war and this whole international situation via the media that tends to flatten out the distinctions that we've been trying to highlight here in this hour. Turkey as a Muslim nation, does it have a similar makeup of Muslims as does Iraq or as does the general Muslim world?
Well, there in your region and in St. Louis, you have, I'm absolutely sure, you have Muslims who are listening right now. You have hit me on my Achilles heel, so to speak, in that Turks are viewed with great derision and, if I may be so bold as to say, with good reason. Turkey has a horrible track record when it comes to human rights. Even though I'm proud to be a Turk, I'm not proud of what we have done as a country. We've slaughtered Armenians, Cossacks, we've slaughtered the Greeks. If you saw my big fat Greek wedding, the grandmother who would run around saying, those dirty Turks. We've fought over Cyprus, we've fought over lands, we've slaughtered Kurds by the millions. And Turkey has a horrible reputation when it comes to human rights. It also is viewed in the Islamic community sometimes with a great bit of disdain. And that is because when the Ottoman Empire fell, 1920s, it also brought with it the fall of the Caliphate. One of the things that I often speak when I speak to colleges and universities is that I tell them Islam is not monolithic. We do not have just one voice. And that is because with the fall of the Caliphate, you lost any unifying voice of the Islamic world. And that is to our great, you know, the Muslims even would say it is Turkey's fault.
The Western perception of Turkey is that it is not an Islamic theocracy like some of the other Muslim nations in the Middle East, mm-hmm. and that there are definitely more freedoms in Turkey. Is this perception true?
Yes, it is. It is absolutely what you just said. It is called a secular state, and this is our hope for Iraq, in that you know, like we were talking about just yesterday. There was the call that Iraq cannot be a secular state. They want it to be an Islamic republic. For a country to be an Islamic republic, this is important. They must adopt the Hadith. They must adopt the 9 volumes of al-Bukhari's Hadith to be their, basically, code of conduct, such as if a man and woman are caught in adultery, the woman is stoned, the man is beaten, the cutting off of the hand, the rules established by Muhammad himself. And if they establish this, there is no such thing in Islam as religious liberty. There is only religious toleration. And that is, they would allow Christians to enter their country, but you must pay a tax. You cannot win anybody to Jesus Christ, as the Great Commission calls us to do. But if you do, you are deported at best. But the one who is converted from Islam, the Quran and the Hadith are very clear. For all your listeners, it is Hadith Volume 9, Number 57. Which Muhammad speaking, Muhammad says, if anyone changes his Islamic religion, kill him.
Are there trends that Turkey is moving toward becoming an Islamic republic and adopting the Hadith perhaps in the future?
Yes, absolutely. November of 2002, the majority rule in parliament was, sad to say, but the Islamic, what they call the jurists movement, we would call in Turkish the jurist movement. And again, I'm very sorry to say, but yes, there is a sign that the only secular experiment, Kemal Atatürk set it up, but the only secular experiment of an Islamic republic, there's a strong possibility it will go the way of the Ottoman Empire as well.
Would you explain, one more question on Turkey, would you explain this distinction that eludes me, but I can see it all over the situation in Iraq and in Turkey, the difference between Turks and Kurdish Turks?
Mm, yes, of course. First off, Kurds would scream at hearing you refer to them as Kurdish Turks, and I would too. I'm in the minority in my country. I'm in the minority in my people. I believe the Kurds have a right to their own land. They are, of course, northern Iraq, southeastern Turkey. They are their own language. They have their own people group. They are more Middle Eastern than they are European. And the Kurds have been under the Turkish rule for many generations. The Kurds believe, and I think rightfully so, that they have a right to self-govern. Turkey does not believe so. And often violently have held them down and kept them from uniting as their own people. As a matter of fact, the only way Turkey was involved in this last conflict is if America assured them that we would not push for a Kurdish nation. I think Turkey, if it's ever going to be accepted into NATO, must allow for some type of Kurdish nation.
Now, back to Iraq for a moment. Given the distinctions that that appear there, and you mentioned in Iraq we're talking about 85% Sunni, 10% Shiite, maybe 5% Sufi. Is there any possibility of some dream of a pan-Islamic government, a secular government that would have representation of all these sects of Islam?
I think when our president declared that we must respond, I mean, I've had protesters everywhere I speak. I speak universities and conferences and crusades and such, and there's always protesters. And when the peace protesters are there, I often tell them, regardless of how big your sign is, regardless of how against this war you are still an infidel to my people. You are, you are still a kafir. You still must die. And one thing that our president did when he said is he said, we are not declaring war. We are responding to a war that has been declared against us. And the one clear thing that got me completely on the side of disbelieving this to be a just war was he said, we must establish a democracy. This is a grand experiment. If, in fact, we establish Iraq, I absolutely believe that if the Iraqis are allowed to have a voice, they will call for a democracy. Because you cannot say that a woman will want to be in an Islamic state that says she is not allowed to be educated, or that her testimony is equal to half of that of a man, or that she is not allowed to have land. I think if the women and the men are allowed to vote, I think they will vote for a democracy, and this, my brother, will be the first time in history, and thus a grand experiment.
We're talking to Dr. Ergun Kaner. He is professor of theology and church history at Criswell College in Dallas, Texas, and author of the book Unveiling Islam. He has a forthcoming book titled More Than a Prophet. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. How much do you believe the Bush administration understands the distinctions and takes seriously and takes these things into consideration, the distinctions among Muslims that we've been discussing up to this point?
Well, certainly a very prescient question. The one man who was, it seemed to me, to be held up as the great legislator of the new Iraq is a Sunni. And I do not believe that this will work. It may work as a pan-Islamic movement. But you cannot disallow for the distinctions between Sunni and Shiite. Shiites believe they have been, and they have, been oppressed by the Sunni in Iraq for so long, and they are the vast majority. And so the Shiite imam, if you're going to get this done, you have to do it on a tribe-by-tribe movement. Iraq is not just one country. Goodness gracious, they never existed as one country before now. They have been a series of tribes, and each tribe has an imam, an ulema. An imam is a pastor. Ulema are scholars. They have had their own seminaries. There's one of the great teaching centers of Shiite Islam there. You're going to have to go tribe by tribe. And if you allow fair representation, I'm terrified that the Bush administration does not know this, but I do know that President Bush has some good advisors. I pray that they make the clear case that you have to be able to find some accord between Sunni and Shiite, and even some of the minority voices, such as the Alawites, and that's the Syrian Islamic movement, and they are there in Iraq as well.
Let's go back to the phones. Roland is calling from his car. Roland, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Fascinating topic. Thank you so much for having your guest on today. Quick question. Whenever you see news footage of a crowd of Islamic people, they're shouting Allah Akbar,
mm-hmm.
or forgive my pronunciation.
No, that's fine. That's fine. That's good.
I don't know if it's a distinction that's too fine, but I've heard that this means one of two things. It either means God is great, or it means God is greater. And if it means God is greater, greater than who or what?
Yes. A tremendous question, and it shows that you pay attention rather than just sit and aimlessly watch the news. Allahu Akbar, which is the call to prayer. It is the call. It is what you hear from every minaret at the five rakats a day, the five prayer times. Allahu Akbar means Allah is great. I do not say, when somebody says, Allahu Akbar, doesn't mean God is great. This is only something I hear here in America. If you would have said to me when I was a Muslim, and I was a Muslim until I was almost 20, If you would have said to me when I was a Muslim that Allah and Jehovah God of the Bible are the same God, I would have been offended. As a Christian, I find it blasphemous. There is no comparison. This is only something that we learn in America because they want us all to be religious. They want us all to be basically, you know, all of us are seeking the same God. You look at the 99 names of Allah in the Quran. They are the names of terror and the names of glory, according to Islam. Not one of them is imminent or intimate or personal. There is no such thing as a Muslim having a personal relationship with Allah. But what we see in the scripture is that I come boldly before the throne of grace to obtain mercy in a time of need, that I am a temple of the Holy Spirit. There is an intimacy that is bespoken in Christianity that clearly distinguishes it from any other movement. Whenever somebody asks me, when did I switch, I always smile and say, I switched nothing. I went from being an idolater to knowing the one true, living, eternal God.
Our phone number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Cindy's calling from South County. Cindy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks. I would like to know what chances you would feel a government set up in Iran by our government has of existing due to the factions in the religious system, and will a government have to still be under a religious system? Because Turkey is sort of like a secular state. Can Iraq do the same thing?
Cindy, thank you very much for the question.
I think it's the only hope we have. If Iraq does not, if let's just say by hypothetical situation that Iraq establishes an Islamic Republic, except this time it's Shiite and not Sunni, then I'm sad to say that we will be back there in another 10 years. We will have to be, and our boys will have to die again in the defense of those who are coming after us. This is not just an issue of establishing some sort of regime. We don't want America to be established in Iraq. We want them to have freedom. Freedom means freedom of all religion. You know, I say this because the clear distinction between religious liberty and what Islam rules, which is called the Pact of Umar, religious toleration, is this. Freedom of religion means I would fight until the death for a Muslim's right to have a mosque in the heart of St. Louis. It also means that I have a right to stand in front of that mosque and tell them that there is no other name under heaven by which man can be saved, Jesus. If they do not have religious liberty, if they do not have a what we would call secular state, what we will see is the establishment once again where the mullahs come out of the mosque and rule the country, and the call will be for the death of the infidel.
Willis is calling from Perryville. Willis, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes. I'm wondering that through the years, I think about 40, 45 years ago, the Lutheran Hour was broadcast in Arabic and those other languages. Are there quite a few people in the Middle East listening to the gospel broadcast, and is it affecting them positively?
Thank you, Willis.
Let me tell you great news, Willis. The Lutheran Hour, not only here in America, but you have on your mission work something that spreads into the Middle East. And please do not think, for all those who say, well, we give our money and we want to know, you know, is it being of any effect, speaking on behalf of all immigrants, I heard the gospel before I came to America. I heard it because of your transmissions, because of your work, because of the fact that you gave your money. Continue to do so, because you will never know what a profound effect it has on the lives of those. I was in Islam. I was the son of a muazzin. The one who does the call to prayer. And yet I heard the gospel because of such moves as the Lutheran Hour and others. You got into our lives because you got into our radios. You got into our televisions. And now, because of satellite, you have an incredible opportunity. This is a time for the church to rise up, for the Lutheran church to rise up, for the various denominations that preach the gospel of Christ as the only Savior to rise up. Man, this is our chance.
Herman is calling from Illinois. Herman, we've only got a very short amount of time here. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
I would like to ask Dr. Kinnear if he thinks that there could be a successful division of creating three separate nations out of Iraq, a Sunni, a Shiite, and a Kurdish.
This was broached at a meeting I was at in Washington, D.C. a couple of days ago. Does Iraq need to be unified? I do not think at the moment that there is very strong movement for a division. Is it necessary? It may be. It may be, but I do not think that at the moment that is on the table.
Dr. Kaner, one last question with only a minute to respond. Some might see the what seems to be intractable differences within Islam as basically the writing on the wall that this world will be torn as Islam rises in political stature and spreads. This world will be torn more and more by the kind of conflict we're witnessing in the Middle East and the kind of terrorism. Is there any way to mitigate that perception of what's going on?
I am premillennial, pre-tribulational. I believe that the world will get worse before the rapture. I think that there is a certain amount of necessity for evil because man is free to choose. I do not see peace in existence until the Prince of Peace returns, as much as I would like to. I think the strength of the church, however, has always been in the midst of peace or in the midst of conflict. We have always been a voice of reason and of hope and a voice that calls all men to love one another in the name of Jesus Christ, our Savior.
Dr. Ergen Kaner, thank you very much for being our guest.
I'm honored.
Dr. Ergen Kaner is professor of theology and church history at Criswell College in Dallas, Texas. He's co-author of the book Unveiling Islam and a forthcoming book, which I'm looking forward to very much, called More Than a Prophet. It can be daunting to realize that what lies before not only Western civilization, but really more importantly, what lies before the church is a world religion that is powerful in its beliefs, that is politically virulent, that is divided in a way that makes for the potential of violence, but also divided in a way that seems to propagate that religion wherever it is found, not only in a political system, but into the very intimate details of the people's lives who live under it as a political system and as a religious system. It can be daunting for the Christian to look at this and say, look at what, not only Western civilization, yes, but look at what we, the church, are up against. And yet we have in our possession a power, and Dr. Kaner spoke about it just a moment ago, a power that is more powerful than the virulent beliefs of Islam. It is the peace, the forgiveness, the love that is the gospel of Jesus Christ. We have the power of God unto salvation for everyone. For everyone. And when Paul says for the Jew and for the Greek, he might as well also include, and we should include, and for the Muslim as well. Dr. Ergen Kaner is an example, a case as an example, but there are many, many more. We need to keep preaching that gospel as the power of God unto salvation. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.